Hyundai gets a new CEO. The UAW out-negotiates Sergio. And VW proves that Americans will buy diesels.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy. For January 3 of 2014, collecting cars inside the Henry Ford Museum. Watch Auto Line After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. Before we get started right now, I want to remind you to tune into our live webcast at the North American International Auto Show. On Wednesday and Thursday of that week, we're going to have the second annual Autoline Supplier Symposium brought to you by our signature sponsor, the Ford Motor Company. And we're going to have some great guests on that show, including Hao Tai Tang from Ford, who now runs all other purchasing operations. We'll also be joined by Linda Hassenfrantz, the CEO of Linamar, Julie Freem, who runs the Original Equipment Suppliers Association, and a whole bunch more guests. The live webcasts are Wednesday, January 15, and Thursday, the 16th. Both those days will be starting at 2 p.m. at Autoline.tv. Once again, we want to thank Ford for its sponsorship, and please tune in. We think you can really learn a lot from that. On today's show, we're going to have Bob Casey coming on later. He's the former transportation curator from the Henry Ford Museum. And we might get Jim McCraw to join us here, too. But I've got Gary Vasilash from Automotive Design and Production magazine.
John,
Gary,
how are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
This chilly, cold, snowy evening.
Well, and that's why I should say, maybe Jim will be joining us because
it's brutal out there.
The weather is horrifically bad here. It's 12 degrees Fahrenheit.
And that'll seem like tropics come Monday. You're talking about like a high of zero.
Oh. And the wind chill is brutal. It's sub-zero with the wind chill. And we've got a mountain of snow that goes along with it. And the traffic is, of course, all backed up, everyone driving slow. So then hopefully Jim will join
us. That nice little Fiesta I have has heat seaters. And what a wonderful development. What a great invention.
And I'm driving a Jeep Cherokee, the Trailhawk edition.
And basically drive up walls.
This thing's great in the snow, let me tell you.
Sure.
Everyone else is going 35. I am not, because this stuff will just get through anything.
Uh-huh.
But here we are, brand new year, and a lot of developments. And first one, I wanted to get your reaction. You know, we learned late last year that John Krafcik was leaving Hyundai Motor America.
Who saw that coming? I mean, you know, John's a guy who you've known him for a long time. I've known him for a long time. We knew him when he was an engineer at Ford, you know, doing some
solid work. I knew him when he was
work.
A grad student at MIT. That's how far back I know John Krafcik.
Sure.
Right.
And, clearly one of the smartest guys in the auto industry. I mean, he was doing the research that was used by Jim Womack
and Dan Jones,
the Welshman, yes.
Right. And the machine that changed the world.
And
Krafcik was one of the researchers on that. In fact, he was one of the foremost researchers on
that. So, the whole understanding of lean production, John's got that. He did a lot of good work at Stanford University as well, you know, in his studies. And, you know, then he gets in the auto industry and does really well. He's at Hyundai for a few years in charge of product development. And, you know, there was that run of CEOs that kept going in and going out and going in and going out, and John maintained. He got the job and seemed to be doing a fantastic job. And I think that a lot of executives in this industry could go to school on John in terms of his accessibility, his rapport, his understanding, his willingness to spend time explaining things to stupid people like me. I mean, it was
and he was great with the media.
Right. I mean, it always seemed to me it was in a very authentic way. I mean, it wasn't like he was trying to sell some snake oil on the side. I mean, it was just basically like he was so much a part of what he was doing. He really wanted you to get it. He really wanted you to understand it. He really believed in what he was doing. And, you know, a few years back when General Motors was having, you know, the 08-09 situation, there was talk that Krafcik might come in and be the CEO of General Motors back then. And, we had the recent change at the top there, and you just got to wonder, was he ever even considered for that job?
You know, to do their due diligence, of course, they'd have to consider a bunch of people. I doubt he was even brought in for an interview, however. Mm-hmm. And to your point, I'm not sure John Krafcik even knew that this was coming himself, that they wanted to replace him. And, part of the reason is it came very late in the year. It came very late on a Friday leading into the holiday weekend.
Mm-hmm.
This wasn't something that, had leaked out or anything. I think it was fairly abrupt decision. I'm sure the decision was made in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
My read of it is that Hyundai's sales have not kept pace with the growth in the American market. John Krafcik, for almost 2 years now, has been complaining, hey, we're capacity constrained.
Sure.
If I could get more cars, I could sell more. I'm not sure the big guys in Seoul, Korea, bought that argument. John's also a guy who really did not like fleet sales, openly criticized competitors who relied heavily on fleet, openly criticized competitors who relied on a lot of incentives. I think that's what Hyundai needs right now, fleet sales and incentives.
Well, except for the fact, though, I mean, if you look at the days to turn vehicles on the lot, I mean, they're turning those cars over like mad, which goes back to his lean production thing, by the way. You know, so he has a very acute understanding of inventory and why you do not want to carry inventory, right? So you want to get things through as quickly as possible. So, you know, if you look at, you know, their availability of vehicles to sell to anybody, I mean, that's his problem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he just needed more cars. He needed more SUVs. I mean, the Santa Fe was doing great, and I was just driving one week before last. I mean, it's really a fine vehicle.
It is.
And he didn't have them.
Yeah.
Although
there are other automakers out there with a lower day supply. Subaru, of course,
right,
is one of the prime examples of that, whose sales have only been skyrocketing.
Sure, but I would submit that Subaru is a company that is selling to individuals. It's not selling to fleets, and therefore that's a very good model. And I think the rationalization is that you're keeping up your residual values by not doing that fleet thing. And this whole taking care of the customer that became so much part of the identity of Hyundai. So here you have a company that, not all that long ago in the history of the auto industry was not looked upon as being a manufacturer of quality vehicles, okay, now to the point where there's Hyundai Assurance, and that actually means something to people. People actually say, hey, you know what, these guys this is a square deal, and it's not all, Jeff Bridges' wonderful voiceovers, and they're really doing it. So I think that John was very protective of that. Now, maybe that was his undoing, but, again, I think that what they have accomplished in a very short period of time is nothing short of astonishing.
I totally agree with that. I find it interesting that they put Dave Zukowski in charge.
Mm-hmm.
He's the new CEO there. He came out of sales, and tells me they want a sales guy.
I was thinking, John, is I was thinking maybe in Korea they're watching the show, because I remember the last time the show was on, when we had the end of the year wrap up, you were saying that it was about time that there was an executive running an auto company that came from sales.
That's right.
And here, like a week later, there it is.
Right. Geez, what else should I say?
Yeah.
Clearly, the people on After Hours should be driving new Rolls Royces.
I thought about that, and I looked at Dave's resume, and yeah, solid sales. I mean, that's his background. You know, he was at Mazda doing sales there, and moved to Hyundai, and he's been doing that straight through. So, we'll see. But
well, I don't think we've seen the end of John Krafcik. I mean, to your point, the guy's too smart, too savvy, has great experience. What a resume! Someone's got to go for him.
You know, but you think about it though. I mean. And you know, the musical chairs that is this industry in some ways. And it at this point in time, I don't see a clear chair for him to sit in. So I think about that, and then I wonder, okay, given his knowledge that transcends the auto industry, okay, that would be something that would make him applicable to a variety of other industries. And I mean, you know, talking to John over the years, I mean, he's become close to the people at Apple. And then I think
there's an interesting thought.
You know, so you want to talk dark horses, and you and I have talked about this a few times on the show, but the Microsoft job. Now, wouldn't John make an interesting candidate? He's a tech savvy guy.
Yeah.
He's comparatively young.
Right.
He's well spoken.
Yep.
I'm sure that he could rally the troops in a very, very adequate way, if not more. You know, but
very interesting thought.
Total long shot, but I mean, but it seems to me that he could show up at a place that we would not.
He could
expect.
He could. My bet is he stays in the industry, in the automotive industry.
So where do you think he would end up?
Well, you know, I've openly speculated on Autoline Daily today, Mazda. You know, the CEO there is probably in the twilight of his career.
Sure. Sure.
Mazda is a company that never has really hit its full potential in the American market. I think Mazda would be maybe somebody that might contemplate somebody like a John Krafcik. Or how about Chrysler? I mean, now that, and we got to get into this in a minute, now that Fiat owns Chrysler lock, stock, and barrel, I mean, I don't see how Sergio can keep shuttling back and forth between the two companies. I think he really needs to become a CEO for the group, and you need somebody running Chrysler and somebody running Fiat Automotive.
Sure.
And I think Krafcik would be ideal for taking over Chrysler.
That's a possibility, but I would be willing to believe that there are some people that are at Fiat right now whose names we don't recognize.
You're absolutely
that would,
right.
That would be, you know, because this is such a tremendous.
It's a plum job.
Yeah, it's not only that, but I mean, it's just there's a lot riding on it, and so wouldn't you want one of your guys? You know what I mean?
Probably, but Sergio's a guy who likes to shake the tree too.
Well, there is that. What about Honda?
Honda, they've got John Mandel, who's running American Honda, and they just got Mike Accavitti over there, who came from Chrysler, as a matter of fact.
Sales and marketing.
Sales and marketing guy.
Okay.
Yeah.
And John's been in the industry for a long time.
Yeah.
And so
that's an interesting thought,
right? And I look at it from the point of view of, okay, what is Honda doing now in a very, very aggressive way? Localizing its footprint in terms of developing products, designing products, engineering products, manufacturing products. I mean, they've done it forever, but now, I mean, there's really
in America
really effort in America.
Right.
So here you have a guy, John, an engineer, understands product development, understands manufacturing. You know, the fluidic sculpture design that Hyundai's known for came under his watch. You know, he ran a company.
No, these are great attributes that you're bringing up. Great attributes. John Krafcik, that would be interesting. And who does Honda probably fear more than anybody else? Maybe Toyota, but of late,
sure,
Hyundai.
Mm-hmm.
So sure, why not go get one of your greatest competitors and bring him in-house?
Right, okay. You know, so we don't know. I mean, it's just, and we don't know. Maybe that already happened. Maybe John left. Okay, maybe it was his decision to end the contract. But here was another opportunity. We don't know.
We don't know, but I bet it was he got a phone call from Korea.
That's
how I think it went.
That'd be awful. But
hey, I mentioned Fiat Chrysler. Now Fiat owns Chrysler lock, stock, and barrel. They gave the UAVWV, but trust fund, it looks to me like all the money that they were asking for 2 years ago.
That's what it seems like
to me
as well.
So why this big haggle back and forth? I don't think Sergio got anything. I think he could have had this done 2 years ago.
Well, he got the 41.6% that he wanted. Wasn't that the number? Something around that.
Something like that.
But, you know, the thing that I wonder is that what's the upside for the UAW?
Remember, it's the UAWV trust.
So. If the profitability of Chrysler increases, the value of their ownership of Chrysler increases. Now, one might make the point that, money in the bank is perhaps better than speculative money and so on and so forth. But, you know, it just sort of struck me as a little odd that they just said, okay.
Well, you hit the nail on the head because they need the money. They desperately need money. The VEBA Trust is seriously underfunded. I mean, seriously underfunded. Many, many, many billions of dollars. So they got to grab what they can get right now, hopefully invest it wisely. I still don't know what they're going to do, though. They're still far short of what they need.
So what does this do to the image of Chrysler in the United States now that it is a wholly owned subsidiary of Fiat?
You know, I think at the showroom level, probably not much impact at all. There's some people who resent the fact that an Italian company now owns Chrysler. And there's others who are making a big stink that, you know, the taxpayers saved this just so an Italian company could take it. But go back to 2009, late 2008. Sergio was the only one in the world who was saying, hey, I'll take it.
Sure.
You know, either the Obama Automotive Task Force was going to shut it down or maybe combine it with Chrysler. That was some of the talk.
With General Motors.
With General Motors, excuse me. But I think Sergio was the only guy who said, no, I'll take it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a miracle has happened. From 2008 to the present, the company has once again reinvented itself, and it's profitable and charging ahead.
Mm-hmm. You think back to the Daimler-Chrysler so-called merger of equals, and they're, you know, very, very protective of the fact that this is a crown jewel of American manufacturing, the Chrysler Corporation, right? And it
was all BS.
Well, but it was presented
that way, right?
You know, because of, you know, the fear of, oh my goodness, we can't let someone know that a German company owns 51% of the business, and it wasn't a partnership. You know, 51% means somebody owns it, right? And you know, so I think we come to forward to today, does the fact that Chrysler is now an Italian company, does it matter to the consumer, or is it just matter to journalists and people who talk about
I think journalists and other pundits are the ones who are going to worry about this. You know, it almost harkens back to the argument, would American consumers buy Hondas and Toyotas made in America?
Right.
Would they buy BMWs and Mercedes made in America? The public doesn't even know.
Right.
I mean, for the most part, they don't know. It's an abstract to them. They walk into the showroom, they see a shiny new car, and it's like, ooh, that's what I want.
Sure. Yeah. And almost the bigger question is, would a German buy a BMW or Mercedes made in America? And they're betting that they are. So,
so many of their SUVs,
all the SUVs are built here by BMW, and then the C-Class will be exclusively built here, I think. The M-Class is coming out of Tuscaloosa for Mercedes, but I think C-Class is going to be out of here. They're going to use those Nissan engines in Mercedes.
Right.
So, what a
jumbled up world, jumbled up automotive
Absolutely.
World. Speaking of engines, we got to get into something that I ran in daily today. You know, Volkswagen claims that Volkswagen Group, which of course includes Audi, they sold 100,000 diesels in the American market in 2013, which, as I point out, is more hybrids, plug-ins, and electrics than Ford or General Motors or Nissan or Honda sold. Not Toyota. Toyota's
right. And,
the Grand
and okay, but see, but that is that's the elephant in the room, and you can't put them aside. And so I looked at the numbers that those guys did.
Yeah.
Okay. That Toyota did.
Yeah.
So Volkswagen Group. So they're saying it's 12 different vehicles are offered with the TDI clean diesel. Mm-hmm. And those engines, as you know, are great. I mean, I love them, you know, and I'm sure you love them as well.
Yeah.
And those are great fun. So, okay, 100,000. Okay, so now these
100,000 plus, because we still haven't gotten December sales out.
Well, see, but I think that they, but I read that, and it says from the Volkswagen and Audi brands this year, the release came out
2013.
It just came out. So I think that they had the numbers mm-hmm. for December. So these are numbers for through November for the Toyota hybrids. Okay.
Yeah, okay.
So 100,000 diesels. Okay. 218,508 Priuses through November.
Yeah.
41,722 Camry hybrids. 14,988 Avalon hybrids. 4,798 Highlander hybrids, 13,284 Lexus CT200s, 14,856 Lexus ES300H, 109 LS600H, 10,154 RX450H for a total of 318,419, okay? 12 Volkswagen Audis. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 Toyotas and Lexuses.
Well, here's another thing, though, to consider. Toyota sells how many vehicles in the American market?
A lot.
2 million?
Okay.
They probably sell four times as many vehicles in the U.S. as Volkswagen does.
All right, so to that point, if you look at total, just Volkswagen, not Audi, I'm not including Audi with this mm-hmm. number. So through November, so these are out of data numbers. Mm-hmm. Okay, through November, they sold, this is Volkswagen, United States, 373,689 vehicles. Okay, so 373. So that is just 55,000 more vehicles than just the hybrids sold
by Toyota.
By Toyota.
Yeah.
All, including Lexus. But so I mean, so to the point of, yeah, I think it's great that these diesels are being sold. I wish that there were more diesels being offered in cars. I mean, we had the assistant chief engineer for the Cruise diesel on the show last summer.
Right.
And I wish there were more. I hope these guys all the success in the world. But I mean, it just seems to me that the phenomenal success that Toyota has had year in, year out, further developing their hybrid systems while everybody else is rapidly trying to catch up just shows that it's really important in some cases to seize leadership of a technology
and
to really optimize what you're doing. And I mean, because how many naysayers were there When the first Prius came out? I mean, that first Prius was a goofy, ugly looking thing that just,
I was one of the naysayers.
And it's like, oh, this is a joke. Nobody's going to want these things. And, you know.
And they didn't.
But Toyota never gives up. Slow and steady wins the race.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Right.
It's like a tortoise and the hare. And these guys just kept at it and at it and at it. And these things have just gotten so good that you can drive one. You have no idea that this is a hybrid. And the only way you know that it's a hybrid vehicle is like, oh, gee whiz, I don't have to go to the gas station quite as often. I mean, that's it.
True.
And so, I mean, you know, I just think it's wonderful that we're getting into a situation where we're beginning to have a proliferation of powertrain technologies that are providing people with the ability to say, hey, I want to get a diesel, or hey, I want to get an EcoBoost Ford engine, or hey, I want to get, you know, the hybrid system from Toyota or from Honda or from anybody else. But I mean, we have this period of time where I think that there's like an explosion of capabilities that are being applied to cars unlike any time ever. I mean, everybody's concentrating on the electronics because you get to see that stuff, right? I mean, you get to see the screens and whatnot. But boy, what makes the car go, that these companies are spending so much time, effort, energy, and money in creating these wonderful things. I just think this is a great time in this industry.
It's the best, and we're going to see a ramp up too, because you know what's driving all this is fuel economy regulations in the U.S. It's CO2 regulations in Europe. That's what's pushing this technology, and as the standards start to ramp up, we're going to see even more.
Oh, sure. And, you know, in the competition, I mean, and it's crazy. And it's another thing I noticed. We talked again in the last show about the Chinese company Qoros.
Yeah.
And so I saw they delivered their first car today. And now the car, the Qoros 3, gets 5-star Euro NCAP, 5-star. So, I mean, we've all seen the YouTube videos of those Chinese cars crumpling like tissue boxes. I mean, and obviously these guys have gotten it right. But I find what's very interesting, two things. One is the company was founded in 2007, and now they're putting out their first car. Mm-hmm. Okay, I mean, time just
well,
really.
First they had to put the company together.
Right.
Then they had to start.
Right, you're talking like from nothing, right? And
kind of like Tesla in a way, kind of.
And the other interesting thing is that, you know, I initially thought, okay, this is going to be a very inexpensive car. You know, it's
here. Ben's got a picture of it up there. That's
nice,
a pretty good looking car.
So I did a exchange rate, figured out what it would be in American dollars from
China.
From the RMBs, and it's starts at 19,817 and goes up to 27,750. So I mean, it's
competitive.
It's not a cheap car. I mean, it's not. Right. I mean, somebody's going to think, oh, I'm going to get an $11,000 Chinese car. You know, that's what you're going to get. And then the thing is that these guys were saying that they've built this modular platform, and they're going to build a family of vehicles with new vehicles coming every 6 to 12 months. Now, you want to talk about a cadence in terms of product from a company that's so young.
Yeah.
And so this is going to cause, I mean, maybe initially not here, but certainly in
China, it's going to be disruptive.
But Asian markets,
to your point, getting the Euro NCAP, rating, clearly they have an opportunity to go to Europe and the U.S. now.
Sure. Sure.
And maybe even charge a little bit more money for those cars.
Who knows?
Yeah.
But, I mean, who would have thought something like that would have been even considered?
That's right. An upstart Chinese company that, you know, is really sort of embarrassing the rest of the indigenous Chinese companies, because out of the box, it's coming out with 5 stars.
Mm-hmm.
And not one other Chinese car company, to my knowledge, has achieved that.
Not that I'm aware of either. But then, you know, you get back to the thing of, okay, so will these guys become a real car company, okay? You know, with the debate of, like, is Tesla a real car company? Can they ever be a real car company? And you look at what the Qoros apparently has done, which is hire talent from established car companies. Now we see Tesla has hired talent from established car companies. I mean, so the barriers to entry used to seem to be so huge that it would be impossible for there to be new entrants. Yet we're seeing new entrants.
Yeah.
And again, what an interesting time. I mean, we're going to talk history here. And you know, back in the day when there were a multiplicity of car companies, I mean, there could have been the Farmington Hills car company that was down the street. But it had always seemed that, you know, that's never going to happen again.
No, you're right. That's a great point. Yeah, we thought the days of new car companies stepping into the market were over. And
sure.
Tesla and Qoros are two great examples so far.
But the thing is that, you know, if you think about, like, again, you go to the computer industry and you think of, like, the computer companies that have gone by the wayside or become irrelevant, that, you know, Gateway or you know, companies like that. And yet new ones emerge, you know, constantly. Mm-hmm. to take over and to do things that are not necessarily being done by the other guys, and they just are filling in these gaps and creating these niches where they didn't exist before. And so you have these new technology companies, and again, It had always seemed that, you know, cars are these old mechanical things and, you know, takes a lot of damn gears to make one of those things. And you know, but meanwhile, these guys in California can just, you know, create things on the screen, and poof, you know, suddenly they have a product. And so you could have many of those companies, but you can't have many of these companies that are making these gear things. But that's changing too, and what a wonderful thing that is. It's just great.
It is. It is. It's a great time to watch the industry evolve. Hey, let's take a quick break, and let's get our guest Bob Casey on. And Ben, let's give a shout out to our good friends at Firestone.
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. Legendary durability. Impressive mileage. Firestone tires. So unstrap the saddle. These old stallions are ready to run. Again. Whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
Whether it's on television, online, or through social media, AutoLine knows how to effectively get your marketing message to the people you want to reach. Contact Stacy Eamon today.
Bob Casey, welcome to AutoLine After Hours.
Thank you for having me.
And so did I say that right? You were the transportation curator at the Henry Ford Museum.
Yes, up until December of last year.
So how's retirement treating you?
I recommend it highly.
That's great. We should also show the audience here that Bob co-authored a book called Driving America. That is just one of the most beautiful car books that captures some of the best cars that you had in the Henry Ford, or have in the Henry Ford Museum.
These are the cars that are on exhibit in the exhibit that's called Driving America. And for the exhibit, we took the opportunity to take these photographs, actually set up a studio in the museum, in the back of the museum, and took these wonderful photographs. And then if you've got all the wonderful photographs, might as well turn them into a book.
And I'm going to open the book and just show some of the pictures. And as you said, this was shot in a studio setting. Mm-hmm. They just didn't walk through the museum and take pictures.
No, these were very carefully staged and lighted create really high-quality photos.
And tell the audience how long it took to stage all these cars for this book.
It was several months, actually.
That's what blows me away.
Yeah,
is how much time that went into it. And this book is beautiful. In fact, some of you may have seen Bob on our television program, AutoLine This Week. But we thought, you know, it was really such a great book that we should show everybody for the AutoLine After Hours audience what all is in here. But you didn't do every single car that's in the museum.
Not every car that the museum owns. It was every car that was on exhibit at the time the exhibit opened.
Uh-huh.
And it opened in January of 2012.
So maybe you should give the audience a sense of what the Henry Ford Museum is, because I think that, you know, we all know what it is and imagine that everyone knows what it is. And you know, you could talk a little bit about the museum and then about the transportation section, which goes far beyond cars, which is astonishing.
And the museum itself goes far beyond cars.
Sure, absolutely.
From the name, you would think that it's a museum about Henry Ford or the Ford Motor Company or certainly cars. In fact, Henry Ford always envisioned it as a museum of American history. And it's 300 years plus of American history. And Ford was really interested in the history of the way Americans lived and worked. He had no interest in political history, no interest in military history. But he had an interest in what today historians call social history, the way we live and work. And so he collected those things that reflected that. From the work side, there's all manner of steam engines and locomotives and stationary steam engines and big machine tools and that sort of thing. But from the agricultural equipment of all sorts, but from the sort of daily life side, there's furniture and kitchen equipment and stoves and cameras and radios and televisions and automobiles. But also, in addition to this massive automobile collection, he collected horse-drawn vehicles, he collected railroad trains, he collected bicycles. So it really is this look at 300 years of the way Americans lived and worked.
But it was more than that, because the museum's got these big, gigantic steam engines. And I don't mean trains. I mean they're pumps. I want to say they're Watt steam engines that he had to go to England to get.
Yeah. He loved steam engines. He truly loved steam engines. And the steam engine was invented in England. And he went to England, or he sent his representatives to England, and they scoured the countryside looking for what were by then, by the early 20th century, obsolete steam engines. And these things are massive. They're 30 feet high. They have huge boilers. And he found them and took them apart, brought them over and reassembled them. Including what is the world's oldest surviving steam engine, which was actually built by a man named Newcomen.
Yeah, it was interesting that the museum continues to collect, though. I mean, it isn't stopped in time. I mean, and it's just so fascinating to see that it's very contemporaneous in many ways. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, I happened to be there last week and took a niece and nephew there, and there was the movie Avatar. They had this huge exhibit with costumes from the film and interactive displays with computers that the kids could use, and I mean it was just fascinating. And so it's living history that is encompassed there. And you know, in the automotive part, Even fast food places, a sign from one of the early McDonald's is there. Mm-hmm. And my brother, who moved from Detroit back in, 1969 or 70, was so proud to show one of his kids, like, that's when McDonald's were 15 cents, and I used to buy those, you know, and there was the sign. You know, I mean, it was just so great to see. And it's just absolutely fascinating. And the only thing that I can think of that is in any way analogous in some ways would be the Smithsonian.
The Smithsonian is the other place that has that sort of huge scope that we have. And you're right. There was a period 40 years ago or so when there was a discussion about whether or not the museum should continue to collect. And at one point, they actually made a cutoff at 1950. And then they realized, you know, people continue to get older. People have children. And the stuff that we're collecting today, it's the same thing that Henry Ford was collecting, same sort of thing in his day. He was not only collecting stuff that was very old. When he was collecting radios, you know, there were radios that might be 10 years old. He realized that the stuff that was being produced was as important as the stuff that had been produced. And so we try to keep that up. And it's a challenge because, of course, so much is being produced. And there's a question of what's really important. And you really need to get a little perspective. You don't want to just run out to Best Buy and buy an armload of electronics. But you really need to keep up with what is happening because this is what's changing the way people live and work.
When you were collecting cars for the museum then, what drove your thinking? What made you think this is one that we've got to go after?
We always looked for vehicles that represented the broad sweep of the American market. And I stress market because it doesn't mean necessarily the industry. It means we're open to collecting vehicles from foreign manufacturers.
As long as they were sold.
As long as they were sold in the American market. So the question is, does this vehicle say something significant about the American market? Is there a does it represent a technological trend or a styling trend? Engineering, marketing, and sometimes you take chances. Sometimes Ford himself collected what appeared to be at the time dead ends. In 19, there was a car that he got. It was built in 1915. It was a hybrid. It was a gasoline electric hybrid. And it sure looked like a complete dead end. Well, it turned out not to be.
There was just a 60-year gap or whatever it was.
He collected steam cars nearly by the time it was clear that steam cars had run their course. But they were an extremely important part at one time of the American market. So you look for all of those things and try to say, how has this vehicle affected the American market? You also, because there's so many vehicles and because vehicles are big, you look for things that are representative. So, for instance, we have one 50s hot rod. We have a wonderful 32 Ford Highboy. We're not going to collect 10 or 20. We have one. For the new exhibit, we collected a Dodge Ram, a 98 Dodge Ram, four-door club cab.
Why that?
Quad cab, as Dodge called it. Well, because that was the first time that an automaker built a four-door pickup for the general market, not for the contractor market or utilities. And that really marked the full transition of the pickup truck into something that was really a substitute for a sedan. And we display that car or that truck with the doors open because you see it's got two full seats and you see it's also got a really nice interior. It's as good as any sedan. And, of course, effectively, it's got this massive trunk. It's also a huge vehicle. I mean, physically, it's just big. And in that exhibit, we have a section on the oil embargoes in 1973. And there we have a 73 Chrysler, which is just immense. And then we go into some of the smaller vehicles and the responses. But you come back, and what it illustrates, I think, is the continuing American preference for the largest vehicle that people can afford. And once the oil prices got relatively reasonable again, you end up with people driving things like four-door Dodge Rams to go grocery shopping.
So do you, as you look over the collection, as you think about it, I mean, is there almost a sinusoidal wave of people big, for whatever reason, go down, back to big, you know, and...
We're attempting to be representative of the trends in the market. And there's always been small cars in America. Well, there's one whole exhibit devoted to small cars, from things like the 50s Nash Rambler, a weird little genre of vehicles that came and went in a couple of years called a cycle car. Up to things like a Honda Accord. It happens to be, and this is one of the few vehicles we don't own. It's on loan from Honda, but it was the first vehicle off the line at Marysville. It's an extraordinarily well-equipped vehicle, but at that time, a Honda Accord was still a small car. And we asked the question, does a small car have to be cheap? Because historically, Americans have viewed small cars as cheap. Well, the Honda Accord was not an expensive car, but it was by no means a cheap car. It was a very well-equipped car. And on the other hand, we've got a 60 Corvair, and that's near the 49 Volkswagen, because Volkswagen tapped into a countercultural strain in the American market, which the big three had to meet. But, of course, as soon as they could, they started making those cars bigger. Sure. And cars like the Pontiac Tempest grow into the so-called intermediates, and then if you put a big engine in them, your economy car becomes a GTO.
And you have the it's the cool Monza Corvette that you guys have, not the.
No, actually it isn't. It isn't the Monza. No, we don't have a Monza.
I had a Monza.
No, no.
You've got some other really unique vehicles in the museum too. Everything from I want to say it's a steam-powered car from the 1870s?
1865, actually.
65. That's just mind-blowing.
A man named Sylvester Roper built it. He built several steam-powered cars, and they were curiosities. People literally, he would show them at county fairs, and people would pay to watch him drive around the horse track at the county fair because it was so unusual to see a vehicle that small. That wasn't the railroad locomotive moving under its own power. He never tried to market it. There was no investors lined up and said, we'll back you in a company, or people weren't lining up saying, Sylvester, we'll write you a check if you'll build us one. It was not until the late 1890s that the public was ready for the idea of a car. And by then, steam-powered cars were viable for a relatively short period of time before the internal combustion engine had improved enough.
And you go to another extreme where you've got one of these Bonneville salt flat belly tank land speed record cars.
That's one of my favorite cars. For people who don't know, during World War II, they made these external fuel tanks for fighter planes to extend their range. They were teardrop-shaped, and they hung on the wings, under the wings, or the belly of a plane. And once they allowed fighters to extend into Germany to escort the bombers. And once the fuel in that external tank was exhausted, they would just drop them. There were lots of these things that were surplus after the war, these wonderful teardropped aluminum hollow shapes. And a hot rodder named Bill Burke had seen these things in the war. He ran the dry lakes in California, and he thought he could make a really fast car with one of those. And he built one after the war, and at Bonneville, they developed a whole class for these things, streamlined cars, but the wheels are open. Mm-hmm. They called them Lakesters, and the fellow that built ours, Tom Beatty, eventually drove like 246 miles an hour in this thing at Bonneville. And you look inside it, and Tom Beatty was a brave man.
This is very clever, though. I mean, think about this for a minute, that because they were used on these bombers, they had to be very aerodynamic because basically they were unsprung weight in a way, right?
That's right.
So to look at that and say, what do we need to do to go fast? We need to be very aerodynamic. Oh, these guys at Lockheed or wherever, they already did all the calculations. Let's just use one of those.
Yep. That's exactly right.
Figure out a way to squeeze the innards of a car inside the shell.
But until you see one of these belly tank racers, you didn't realize, or I never realized, that those belly tanks were as big as they are. I mean, that's enough to put a human being and an engine and everything else inside of it.
He built one originally with a P-47 tank, which was smaller, and then he found these P-38 tanks that were bigger, and they were better suited for his purpose.
I didn't know the difference. I didn't know that. And then you've got couple of presidential limousines. You've got the limousine that President Kennedy was assassinated in.
We have four presidential Lincolns, and people wonder, why do we have them and not the Smithsonian? Well, for 40-plus years, Lincoln leased cars to the federal government, and starting with a Lincoln used by Franklin Roosevelt. And like any leased car, when the lease is up, it reverts to the manufacturer. And so those cars would go back to Ford, and Ford gave them to us. So we have these four vehicles running from Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Nixon, Ford, Carter, and
Reagan.
Reagan.
Yeah, it's very impressive the way you see those cars. I mean, you just walk along, and there's nice graphic displays and showing the presidents and showing the cars, and it's just, you know, patriotic. And, I mean, yeah. it just really is. I mean, to say, wow, those are the presidential cars,
and you see that the early cars were open and not armored, and the Kennedy car was originally open and not armored until after 1963, and then it was rebuilt and armor-plated with a permanent roof, and presidents will no doubt never ride in an open car again.
And you have a variety of because this was part of transportation and travel, trailers and of different sorts and camping vehicles. And
there's a trailer that Henry Ford bought new in the 30s. Because he said, "This is something that's coming. This I ought to own this in the museum." And then he became friends with Charles Lindbergh, and he gave the trailer to Lindbergh. And Lindbergh used it on family vacations. They kept a record on the bottom of one of the drawers inside of their itineraries. And also, Lindbergh and his wife, when they would park it at their wherever they lived, their house, and they would write books in it. I used it as a study. And then Lindbergh, when his family was grown up, he decided to give it back to the museum. So it started out as what we would call today contemporary collecting, Henry Ford collecting something that was new and modern. And then because of the Lindbergh connection, it's got this whole other layer of history that's built on top of it.
Race cars, too, play a prominent role. In fact, the museum is constructing or has constructed a whole display to racing.
Part of the exhibit is a race car display, and they're working and actively fundraising on a bigger exhibit called Racing in America. But we've got this really fine collection of racing cars. We had a number of those cars. Not surprisingly, it was a Ford Heavy a group of cars, but it was cars like Jimmy Clark's 65 Indianapolis winning Lotus and the Dan Gurney A.J. Foyt car that won Le Mans in 67, Henry Ford's 999. I mean, great cars like that. And then while I was there, we were able to add cars some like this Belly Tank Lakester or 56 Chrysler NASCAR car.
Truly a stock car.
It was. It's scary how stock it is. And in 56, the Chryslers were run by a guy named Carl Kiekhaefer, and they dominated NASCAR with the Chrysler 300s. And Kiekhaefer, in many ways, sort of presaged the modern NASCAR owner. When the Wood Brothers car won the Daytona 500, they gave that car to us. And so it's next. And so you see these, I mean, startling. Of course, the modern NASCAR car is a stock car in name only. It's got sheet metal that now looks more like real cheap production cars. But you look at those two cars side by side, it's amazing how different they are. We've got a dirt track car that A.J. Foyt won his first national championship race in. And so we've got a couple of dragsters. We tried to cover kind of all the genres of auto racing.
That's great. Hey, why don't we get to some of the other questions that we've got coming in from our audience right now. It's what we usually call the rapid fire part of the show. But Scott in Snowy Cleveland wants to know, what's the other presidential limousine in the collection parked behind the JFK limo?
Oh, that's the what we referred to as the Eisenhower car. It was actually built for Harry Truman, and it was used by Truman. It was used for 8 years by Eisenhower, and it was most associated with him. It was also used by Kennedy for a short while before the new Lincoln was ready for him.
Goggles Pisano wants to know, Bob Casey, what five cars would you like to have had in the Henry Ford Museum that you could not get for one reason or another?
Oh, Lord. I'm not sure that I can answer that in a rapid fire.
well, name one.
Fire way. well, here's one that people might think is off the wall. It's a car we actually tried to get and weren't able to. When Danica Patrick became the first woman to win an IndyCar race, we actually tried to get her car. But, you know, race cars are expensive, and they've continued to use that chassis. So we were not able to get that car. But we thought that would be an interesting vehicle to get.
Give it a few years. I think that'll go down in price at some point.
It probably will. Yeah.
Mark Tilton says, when I saw Bob Casey at the Miller reunion at the Milwaukee Mile 10 years ago, I knew the right guy was at the Henry Ford. But he goes on to say, he says, you were trying to get all the Miller front-wheel drive Fords from the Indy 500 together at one time. Is that right?
We do have a Miller Ford, although the car never actually got to the 500. But that would have been a nice thing to do, but we were never able to do that.
He also goes on to ask, did you ever have any dealings with Andy Granatelli and his cars?
I met him once when he was actually being inducted into the Motorsports Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. He wanted to come to the museum. And he called us and asked if we could get one of those little electric scooters for him, which I was able to arrange, and was able to meet him briefly at the Hall of Fame induction. And then he later sent me one of his books, autographed copy of They Call Me Mr. 500, and I was saddened to hear about his recent.
I had missed that, that's what
he
was
90 years old.
Wow, that's it.
Yeah,
that's a good old age. Here's an interesting question from Rumman Koch. He says, "Did the museum grow out of Henry's personal collection, and did Henry have anything to do with the museum personally?"
It did grow out of his personal collection. He started collecting historical things. Things that he was interested in, clocks and watches and steam engines, and it just kind of grew. And he seems not to have had an original vision for this. This was old stuff that was going away. He was busy changing the world. And he realized that a lot of the world in which he'd grown up was going away. And so he collected pieces of it, and eventually the idea of a museum began to grow in his head. And he had he took a tremendous personal interest in it, from everything from the design of the building, the buildings that were being purchased and erected in Greenfield Village, the arrangement of the buildings, the arrangement of things in the museum. He took a very, very personal interest in it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's an important point about Greenfield Village being part of this, where, you know, talking about collecting, I mean, when he collects, the Wright Brothers bicycle shop and has it built and the Menlo Park Laboratory that Thomas Edison did. And it raises a question that there are vintage Fords that are driving around Greenfield Village, are those authentic cars, and did you guys have something to do with that?
It's interesting. There are some authentic cars. Well, it depends on what you mean authentic. There are some that were built by Ford Motor Company as part of the Model T's natural life. There are a handful that are what we referred to as centennial Fords. In 2003, for the motor company's centennial, Ford built a series of Model Ts using, as near as they could, contemporary materials and there were a few things they didn't create. They didn't recreate engines. They used vintage engine blocks. All the engines were rebuilt. But most of the parts in there, they had made just for the purpose, which means they were very expensive Model Ts. And they gave some of those to us, and then we bought a number of Model Ts that had been restored. And they put 8,000 to 10,000 miles a year on those cars.
Just driving around the village?
Driving around Greenfield Village.
Wow.
There are at least a dozen of them. And so that there's always some in the shop. There's always some running. You put that many miles on a car, especially a car of that vintage, over time, you replace a lot of parts. And so they're authentic in that we keep them true to the year of the Model T, and we have a range of them. But
they were not built in the Highland Park
Assembly
Plant.
They were not built in the Highland Park Assembly Plant. And lots of parts now are contemporary replacement parts because that's just what happens when you drive cars that much. The one concession that they did do is they put starters on all of them just for safety's sake.
Mm-hmm. But for the people who go to the village who take a ride in one of these vehicles, this is as close as you could get to what it was
it
back
is,
then.
Yes, absolutely. They have a wonderful group of drivers who are very skilled at driving Model Ts and know a lot about them. And it's as authentic as it would have been in 1915 to be riding in a Model T.
It's not like a Disney World fabrication of this is what
fiberglass bodies and Pinto
right.
engines. they are Model Ts.
That's cool. Hey, it's probably unrelated to this discussion, but we did get a phone call to come in. And Ben, why don't we bring in that phone call?
This is Clem Zarovsky, Delmont, Pennsylvania. I noticed that Chevrolet now is opening up the sales of the 2014 Corvette to all dealers. Originally, it was only to dealers who sold four Corvettes in 2012. Does this mean the Corvette sales are slow? Thank you very much.
I don't think Corvette sales are slow. My guess is Chevrolet recognizes it's got a chance to sell a whole lot more Corvettes than it ever did in the past.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, the early number, you got to give this a little bit of time, but I don't think we've seen any real trend yet in sales that I'm aware of.
No.
As to how the new model's doing.
And what I think is advantageous for Corvette that the New York Times, when Jim Cobb and Lawrence Ulrich did their 10 best cars of the last year, they both had Corvettes on their list. And they both said, you know, historically we maybe wouldn't be all that keen on these cars. And so when you have a publication like that, which is basically going out there and saying, so I have a feeling that's got to be good for Todd and the guys over at Corvette.
That's exactly right. We got one more question out of the chat room. People are wondering where Peter is. Peter is down in Daytona right now. You know, the 24-hour race is coming up this weekend.
Poor guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Down in Daytona.
Somebody has to
yeah.
do it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right.
I'm sure the weather is a lot more pleasant than it is up here. And Peter will be back, of course. He'll probably rotate in not as frequently as he has in the past, but he'll be back. And so we probably have hit on all the questions that were directed to you, Bob, and I really want to thank you for coming on the show. This book, Driving America, I highly recommend to anybody. It's a little bit pricey. It's around $100, but
it's pricey.
What a book. It's beautiful.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. It's always a pleasure.
And so cool to hear how you guys did everything at the Henry Ford Museum. What a job. What a career you had there.
It was fun.
Gary Vasilash, thanks so much for coming over. Great having you as always.
Not at all, John. Anytime.
Great discussion there that we had, really.
Very nice meeting you. And
nice to meet you.
It's a great place, and you know, as I said, I just coincidentally was there last week with the niece and nephew and had no idea that I'd be doing this, and I highly recommend it to anybody who's not been there. And if you've been there, go again.
Go again, yes.
That's right. Well, good, and we want to thank all of you who have tuned in with us.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.